You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Up next, Silicon Valley. You know, it's full of engineers and entrepreneurs who, backed by venture capital, design those high-tech computers, the cell phones, the internet gadgets that have changed our lives. If we're talking this hour about creating another shift in our lifestyle, you know, an alternative energy source, maybe, you know, wind or whatever it is, could be solar, why don't we ask those folks over there in Silicon Valley to turn their massive brain power to the challenge of inventing clean, abundant, non-polluting renewable energies of the future? Well, lucky for us, they don't need much convincing. They believe that the time is right and the market is ready for what they have to offer. And here's the evidence. Listen to this. A new report says Silicon Valley investment in renewable technologies jumped from $34 million in the first quarter of 2006 to $290 million in the last quarter. That's almost 10 times over the period of just 1 year. So for the rest of the hour, we're going to talk to one venture capitalist about why he thinks the time is right for Silicon Valley to make its mark in the energy arena and the promising technologies he sees in our future. So give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. John Denniston is a partner in the venture capital firm of Kleiner Perkins Caulfield and Byers in Menlo Park, California. He joins us today from his office there. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Ira.
Is Silicon Valley ready?
Silicon Valley's ready. You better believe it. Silicon Valley is hard at work on this project.
And in what ways? Give us an example of projects that you guys are investing in.
Sure. Well, we're investing in many projects. We're investing to support scientists, engineers, and entrepreneurs working on a whole range of breakthroughs in energy, transportation, and in some cases, even water industries. One good example, Ira, would be in the solar field, where out there in the world today, it's become a relatively large market. It's grown from a very small market 5 years ago to, in 2006, roughly a $12 billion industry. And 90% of the solar installations are done on silicon. It's just plain silicon, very similar to the materials that are used by the semiconductor industry. And so we're hard at work on projects that are looking for new ways to convert photons from the sun to electrons that are usable in homes and in businesses. And so there are many of those that are coming to the fore, and it's very encouraging to see the innovation that's coming forward and to see the talented entrepreneurs that are so excited to work in this field.
Well, there's one major player that's even getting bigger in Silicon Valley called NanoSolar, using nanotechnology.
That's a fact. That's a fact. Yeah. And so that is an effort to discover new materials that have the property of both achieving higher efficiency, so converting photons to a greater number of electrons, and doing it at lower cost. And the objective of the industry is to achieve electrical generation capability at prices that compete with grid prices. And that's not where the industry is today. And in fact, the industry wouldn't exist today but for subsidies that have been put in place by governmental organizations. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the industry today, Ira, roughly 90% of the industry is in three geographic locations: Germany, Japan, and the state of California, all driven by subsidy. But that will change over time as these technologies improve and as the cost curves come down.
Let's talk about that, because 10 or 15 years ago, there was investment in some of these alternative entrepreneurial ventures. What has changed in the last few years to make it now, you know, I mentioned there was a tenfold increase just this year almost in investment.
Absolutely. And it's a terrific question. I think it's the right question for our industry. And as I say, we're looking to support the entrepreneurs and the scientists that are coming forward with breakthroughs in the what we call the green tech field. Everything that you're describing is green tech. And I'd say there are three reasons that we're excited to be working in this field today. The first is new technologies. So there have been recent technology developments that give alternative energy a shot for the first time, I think, of competing with the incumbent sources like the power grid and lead-acid batteries. So there have been a whole wide range of technological breakthroughs in the past couple of years in areas like material science, electrical engineering, synthetic chemistry, synthetic biology, and even other areas that individually have important ramifications for the green tech industries. And when those innovations are actually combined on a single project, have the chance of making an enormous difference. So that's one. New technologies that didn't exist 5 or 10 years ago maybe give alternative energies the opportunity to compete on a price-performance basis. Number two is talent. And we are seeing an acceleration of very talented entrepreneurs, scientists, and engineers running into this sector. And in some cases, they're driven by the cause, in other cases by profit, and in yet other cases by both. And the third reason I'd identify for you, Ira, is energy prices. So oil prices in the $50 to $60 a barrel range creates a price umbrella that is just plain different than the one existed when we had $10 and $15 oil.
Mm-hmm. I was talking to some entrepreneurs a few days ago who were saying, you know, Silicon Valley and the computing industry has just about run its course. I mean, it hasn't got a real monopoly anymore. You have chip makers making things overseas. There's competitors in India and China. Maybe that's the reason that Silicon Valley is turning towards something where it can create another big niche for itself, and that would be with green technology.
Well, I guess my answer to that would be I don't agree with that. I don't think the IT revolution has ended, and we continue to see breathtaking innovations that will make differences in the ways in which we all live and work. And if you looked at the aggregate funding numbers for the information technology industry from the venture capitalists, you would conclude that those remain large numbers, and in fact, IT funding is significantly greater than the funding going into green tech.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've also sponsored a contest. Tell us about this prize.
Yeah, well, we have, and maybe I'll start by telling you, Kleiner Perkins last year formed what we call the Green Tech Innovation Network, with 50 of the world's leading entrepreneurs, scientists, policymakers, and even green-minded Fortune 100 business leaders. The goal of the network is to forge new partnerships and build a strategic map for evaluating needs and encouraging innovation. Last year, we established a Green Tech Prize to encourage innovation in the areas of clean water, power, and transportation. And we received a very large number of applications. And we awarded the prize to Dr. Eli Gall, who invented a unique chilled ammonia-based process that captures carbon emissions from power plants. And this new process delivers CO2 capture rates in excess of 90%, a very high figure, lowers the cost of scrubbing emissions by half relative to existing scrubbing technologies, and has the additional benefit of requiring as little as half the power needs that other scrubbing technologies require. And this new technology is being installed this year in a pilot plant. We think it's very exciting and can make a very big difference.
So you think that, you know, I look at the success that contests have had in spurring entrepreneurs. I'm thinking especially like the X-Plane and things like that have really brought out some real good talent. Do you think that could happen too in your area?
We're seeing the answer is absolutely yes, and we are seeing that happen. And we're very pleased. We're thrilled with the response that our prize received. We will do it again this year and expect that the reception will be even greater.
Do you think that the government needs to still step in and play a role in making the green revolution a reality, or is it green enough? Is it greened up enough that the private industry can take over the brunt of the work?
Well, here's the problem, and I thought it was an excellent interview that you conducted earlier in the hour with the IPCC person from Paris, and it depends what problem you're trying to solve, Ira. So I would identify three problems. Climate change is one. The second is the inexorable trend towards urbanization on the planet, where we will have 4 billion people in the next 50 years move from rural to urban areas, and just think about the ways that they will consume power. Mm-hmm. and number three, American competitiveness. And so I'll focus just for the moment, because I think that's a topic of great interest today, given the IPCC report's release earlier today, mm-hmm. on carbon emissions. The problem with carbon emissions today, if you believe that we are in a climate change crisis, and I do, there is nothing in our market economy that puts a cost on carbon. And so left to its own, the free market would certainly introduce new technologies, and the favored technologies would be those that have a price advantage over the incumbents. Mm-hmm. That's the way the market works. Mm-hmm. Some people will buy on green. Most people will buy based on economics. And so if we're serious about solving the climate change problem, you would think that public policy would want to come forward with something that places a price on an externality, that is carbon emissions, that aren't priced today. And there are several proposals running around on that from various flavors of a cap-and-trade system. A cap-and-trade system creates a market for carbon emissions, places an overall cap for a country or for the world or for a state, take your pick, and those that exceed their caps have to pay for that privilege, and those who emit less than their targets can sell credits, carbon credits, and actually make money by becoming greener. The other flavor of policy proposal is to just put a simple tax on carbon emissions, and there are various complicated policy arguments that might favor a cap and trade over a carbon tax and vice versa.
Let's go to the phones. Chris in Fort Lauderdale. Hi, welcome to Science Friday. Hi, Chris. Are you there? Oh, Chris, last chance? No, I guess not. Do you think that the government should keep on some subsidies? Like, I know that what has made, we talked about wind power, what has made wind power successful is that it is subsidizing the cost per kilowatt hour, giving a few cents a kilowatt hour to producers. That kind of incentive versus the kind of capping and trading of carbon dioxide gases.
Well, so the government has a lot of different tools, and the truth is the green tech sector is vast, and it's dangerous to think of green tech as a monolithic industry. It isn't. Mm-hmm. There are numerous sectors, for example, energy generation, energy storage, transportation vehicles, transportation fuels. Each one massive in scale with its own unique set of characteristics and challenges. And so there are probably a large number of policy proposals that ought to be enacted. Unfortunately, we've not seen a groundbreaking piece of legislation in the energy field in many, many, many years. And I think that there is some hope this year in 2007 that we might see something done. To your specific question on subsidies, yes, I do think that there is a place for that. We have one today, for example, in the biofuels sector where there is a 51-cent per gallon ethanol subsidy. It's called the blender's credit. The reason it's called the blender's credit is because for historic reasons going back 30 years ago, the blender's credit goes to the company blending ethanol into gasoline. That's typically the oil company. And so one policy proposal would be to have that subsidy go directly to the ethanol producer, if in fact we're trying to incent alternative fuels.
And maybe let me just jump in. I have to remind everybody that this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News.
Sure.
I'm sorry, John Denniston. Go ahead.
No, that's fine. The final point, Ira, that I was going to make on the ethanol subsidy, on the biofuel subsidy, is while we're at it and looking at restructuring, why don't we structure the subsidy so that the payment per gallon, it's a little bit complicated, is inversely related to the price of oil. So in that way, alternative fuel makers will be able to survive even during times of very low oil prices, and the government won't have to provide any subsidy at all in very high oil price conditions. And again, if we're looking for a sustainable, long-term alternative to crude oil and to create energy independence, you would think that it would be in our interest as a country to structure these subsidies in a way that ensures the survival of our native industries.
As a venture capitalist who's looking to invest in new green tech, what do you look for in a company? Well, how do you weed them out, and where are they? Yeah, where's the fertile ground?
It's a great question. I wish there were an easy answer that everyone could say, "Aha, that's how we do it." But I'll share with you this, and this is the way that the venture capital industry has invested and made investment decisions in their historic industries. So semiconductors, everything you named before, computers, software, and the life sciences, biotechnology, and medical devices. And it really comes down, Ira, to marrying world-class scientific talent with world-class entrepreneurs. And so it's having the scientific know-how and having the company-building know-how. And then if you combine those two and aim that combined product at large markets, mm-hmm. then very good things have happened historically and I think have the potential of happening in the green tech sector.
Mm-hmm. How fast do you think this field is going to expand in Silicon Valley?
Well, you correctly pointed out that the year-to-year growth is 10x, and I think we will continue to see it grow. I think that the opportunities for change are very large. The truth is that we haven't seen groundbreaking innovations in the energy sector in a very, very long time. You and I talked about that a little bit earlier. Why now? I gave some reasons for that. And I think we will begin to see some new technologies, very exciting ones, come forward into the market over the coming years, in some sectors sooner than others. As I say, it's dangerous to think of mm-hmm. the green tech sectors monolithically, but in the solar field, in the biofuels field, to give two examples, I'll give a third, batteries and storage, I think you'll see some exciting innovation over the coming few years.
Well, John Denniston, I want to thank you for taking time to be with us today, and good luck to you.
Thanks, Ira. Thanks very much.
John Denniston is partner in the venture capital for Kleiner Perkins, Caulfield & Byers in Menlo Park, California. This program is produced by Karen Vergoth and senior producer Annette Heist. Our directors are Sarah Handel in Washington and Charles Berquist in New York. Flora Lichtman is our producer for digital media. Becky Vlamis and Barry Hardiman work the phones for us today. Kimberly Jones is our technical director. Our audio engineers here in New York are Neil Rausch and Josh Rogerson. If you'd like to write us, please send your letters to Science Friday, 4 West 43rd Street, New York, New York, 10036. Put on room 306 on that. Also, surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, where we're podcasting and blogging. You can download previous editions of Science Friday. Also, Science Friday's Kids Connection is there. Just click on the For Teachers button. And also, we have links to Science Friday group and in Facebook. So stay with us in all different venues of Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.